The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
The line who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, so of course it's time for the visit of our dear friend, Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you. Yes, thank you, Andrew.
Excellent. And Peter's got a fascinating topic for us, as always, and we'll get into that in a moment. I'm just going to timestamp even and date the show. It is Tuesday, April the 16th, 2024. It is 10:08 here in the UK, making it 11:08 in the morning over in South Africa. Peter has a subject today for us entitled "The Real Story of the Origin of the Term Genocide." So, Peter, where would you like to start us off with today's topic?
Andrew, we are 109 years away from the Armenian Genocide of 1915, which is where the term genocide was first coined. So back in 24th of April, April is the month that one generally remembers the Armenian Genocide, which is actually much more than the Armenian Genocide, big as that was. It includes genocide of Assyrian and Greek Christians in the Turkish Empire as well. So 24 April marks the anniversary of the launch of the systematic extermination of Christian Armenians by the Ottoman Turks. And our listeners should be aware of the fact that the Ottoman Turks, the so-called Young Turks, actually originated from Salonika, which is long connected with the Sabbatean Celts. And so we had this program years ago on the 1666 and the Sabbatean Roots of the New World Disorder. And it's based on how Sabbate Zevi declared himself the Messiah back in 1666. And more than half the Jewish population in the 17th century came to accept him as their Messiah. Now, the Sabbateans worked on salvation through deception, and it was the whole idea of a redemption is achieved through deception. Salvation comes through sin, and redemption is achieved through deception. And so Sabbate Zevi shows the way by converting to Islam, and he found, because Islam was the primary religion and political power of the Ottoman Empire, he and his followers pretended to be Muslims. And later on, his followers, Jacob, Frank, and others based in Poland, advocated also becoming Christians, whether Protestants or Catholics, pardon me, because that's where the power base was in Europe, and that the way to take over every kingdom and empire and destroy them all and replace them with their version of Zionism was to infiltrate and deceive, and that they must lie about what the real beliefs are, hide their beliefs, and we've documented all this in our 1666 and the Sabbatean Roots of the New World Disorder. Well, the Young Turks were basically Sabbateans, and so while we blame the Muslims for the Armenian Genocide, it's interesting to note that actually the Sabbateans were behind them and engineering this whole operation that led to the country of Turkey and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, which of course was a Sabbatean goal as well. The term genocide comes from a Greek word genos, which means race or people, and a Latin suffix sedo, which means the act of killing. So genocide or genos sedo is a term that the Armenians came up with to explain what was going on with the systematic destruction of the Armenian Christians. And this jihad began with the arrest of 250 Christian leaders in Constantinople, what today is called Istanbul, 24th April 1915. Over 800 other Christian leaders throughout the empire were arrested on that same day, 24th of April 1915. Ultimately, before the end of 1915, 1.5 million Christians had been slaughtered by the Muslims in Turkey, mostly in eastern Anatolia, where the Armenian people lived. And Armenia was one of the very first nations to convert to Christianity, and they've got a tremendous Christian heritage dating back to the 2nd century. And the Armenians came into what is today Turkey, or Anatolia as it was called at that stage, 1,500 years before the Turks first arrived. So to call it Turkey today is to ignore the fact that it used to be part of the Byzantine Empire, used to be part of the Greek civilization. And not only were 1.5 million Christian Armenians slaughtered by the Turks, but there was another 750,000 Assyrian Christians. And the Assyrian Christians, of course, are scattered all the way over, not just Turkey, but also Iraq and Iran. And many of them were persecuted severely during the time of the Muslims taking over Iran and Iraq. The Assyrian Christians were some of the people who Mel Gibson turned to for speaking Armenian in the Passion of the Christ film. And so Assyrian Christians who've survived, especially in Iraq, played a role in the Passion of the Christ film, you might be interested to know. Another 950,000 Greek Orthodox Christians were murdered in the Turkish Ottoman Empire between 1915 and 1922, culminating in the destruction of Smyrna, the last great Christian city in Asia. Smyrna is, of course, in the Book of Revelation, is one of the one of the seven great churches of Revelation that gets a letter addressed by Christ himself. Well, that amounts to 3.5 million Christian victims of the Turkish Empire in just over 7 years, between 1915 and 1922. And behind it was the Sabbatean cult of Sabbati Zevi and Jacob Frank, which, of course, morphed into the Illuminati and the Marxist movement. In fact, the Sabbatean goals and the goals of the Communist Manifesto are very, very, very similar, and they overlap. And when the Illuminati was launched in 1776, it was basically a culmination of the Freemason movement, the Marxist movement, revolutionary communism, all joining together with the Sabbatean cult. And that's actually quite extraordinary how that all worked together. So nihilism and deception was designed to destroy Christian Europe. And their whole goal was destroying Christianity, destroying all kingdoms, all countries, all nations on earth, and to destroy them. And the 1st of May 1776 was chosen by Weishaupt to launch the Illuminati in accordance with the Sabbatean Kabbalah's teaching. He chose the 1st of May because May, the fifth month, added to the first day equals six. He chose 1776 because the four numbers of this year add up to 21. 1 plus 7 plus 7 plus 6 equals 21. And the sacred number 6 plus 21 equals 27, another number that was identified in the Kabbalah, as having occultic powers. And they believe that this dating is important, and it's formed also by multiplying 3 by 9. And Weishaupt carefully chose the date because he believed even the greatest plans would be doomed to failure if not carried out on the most numerically advantageous time. And Adam Weishaupt, Meyer Rothschild, and Jacob Frank launched the Illuminati the 1st of May 1776 in Frankfurt. And their long-term political goals, they stated, was abolition of all monarchies and all governments, abolition of private property and inheritance, abolition of nationalism, abolition of the family and the institution of marriage, abolition of all religion, and establishment of compulsory communal education, or should we say indoctrination of all children. And when you compare that to the goal of Marxism, of communism, it just overlaps tremendously. And if you've read the book The Naked Communist, you'll recognize immediately what their goals are. And so the communist goals are abolition of private property, heavy progressive income tax to confiscate land, property, and especially inheritance, abolition of all rights of inheritance, confiscation of property of all immigrants and rebels, a central bank, government control of communications and transport, government control and ownership of factories and agriculture, government control of labor and corporate farms, regional planning, government control of education, of course. So the Sabbatean goals and the Marxist goals are massively overlapping. So what happened was the Ottoman Empire, which of course had been massively infiltrated by the Sabbatean movement anyway, declined into corruption and degeneracy actually from the beginning. When Sultan Mumrad III died in 1595, his son Muhammad had his 19 brothers murdered to prevent them from claiming what he called his throne. He had seven of his father's pregnant concubines sewn into sacks and thrown into the river, and many of his nephews were incarcerated in the cage. Sultan Ibrahim threw his grand vizier into a cistern to drown, and one morning after an orgy, Ibrahim had all 300 women of his harem put into sacks and thrown into the Bosphorus to drown. Only one survived by being picked up by a ship bound for France. When Ibrahim was finally assassinated, the Ottoman Empire was being torn apart by more corruption, nepotism, inefficiency, misrule, and power struggles. Sounds pretty much like what we're dealing with in the world today. In the early 19th century, the Ottoman Empire suffered defeats at the hands of Russia and Austria and at the hands of the Greeks and Serbs, who successfully mounted wars of national liberation. At one time, the Ottoman Empire controlled a good part of Europe, all the way up to the gates of Budapest and Vienna. And, of course, they'd been pushed away from Vienna in 1688 with the Great Siege of Vienna. And so the Ottomans lost their European territory in the 19th century, being kicked out of Greece first and then out of Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, and systematically they lost their footing in Europe. So in the early 19th century, Muhammad II decided to massacre all the Janissaries. And the Janissaries were soldiers recruited forcibly from Christian families. And the Janissaries were the elite of the Ottoman Empire, but they were part of the blood tax. One out of every five males born to Christian families had to be forcibly recruited, conscripted into the Janissaries as the Sultan's shock troops, who were, of course, completely expendable because they meant nothing to the Muslim rulers. Now, of course, bear in mind, behind all this is the Sabbatean movement, but despite the adoption of a Western-styled constitution in 1839 to placate the European powers, the last century of the Ottoman rule witnessed the most thorough and complete destruction of Christian communities throughout the Middle East and Asia Minor, the Caucasus, and which the Caucasian Mountains are between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, which is where the mountains of Ararat are, the traditional homeland of the Armenian people where Noah's Ark settled. So in 1822, the entire population of the island of Chios, tens of thousands of people, were massacred or enslaved. In 1823, 8,750 Christians were slaughtered by the Turks at Missouri. Thousands of Assyrian Christians were murdered in the province of Mosul in 1850. And it's these atrocities that led the Russians to demand the right to protect the holy places, which were under Orthodox supervision in the Middle East and then under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And with the accession to power in France of Napoleon III in 1852, he sought to provoke an international crisis by demanding that the Turks rather place the holy places in the Middle East under the power of the Roman Catholic Church rather than the Russian Orthodox Church, who at that stage were the custodians. And as Napoleon III's new French regime was completely secular, this was obviously a very cynical, manipulative diplomatic move designed to provoke a war with Russia, because Napoleon III didn't care about Christianity and he sure didn't care about the holy places, and he had no real allegiance to the Catholic Church either. So Napoleon III's France assumed the role of a Catholic crusader in aid of the Islamic Crescent. I mean, how's that for bizarre? Not fighting for the cross, but fighting for the crescent, really. Effectively supporting the most bloodstained, despotic, corrupt rule in Europe, the Ottoman Turkish Empire. And this move led to soaking the continent in blood. The Crimean War, over 800,000 people died in the Crimean War as a direct result of Napoleon III's campaign to fight for Islam and the Turkish Empire against Christian Russia, who were the custodians of the holy places in the Middle East. And so far more serious than the actual loss of lives and limbs in that ruinous Crimean War was the British and French actions in the Crimean War extended the worthless existence of this corrupt Turkish tyranny, who thereafter targeted the Christians, which previously had been under the protection of Tsarist Russia, and they attacked Christians with greater ferocity with the support of France and Britain behind them. So systematically, Russia had been working at freeing Christians from Ottoman Turkish control. They liberated the Balkans. They supported liberation movements that brought about independence for Bulgaria and Serbia and so on. They forced the Turks to respect religious freedom of their Christian subjects. And as Russia was extending Christian civilization across the whole of North Asia to the Pacific Ocean, they were also pushing southward in their civilizing mission, seeking to liberate the holy place in Palestine, which were then controlled by the Muslim Turks of the Ottoman Empire, which at that stage was being so infiltrated as to be controlled by the Sabbatean cult. So if it hadn't been for the untimely intervention of Great Britain and France, and one wonders why, maybe Sabbateans had infiltrated Great Britain and France to that extent, certainly the Freemasons had, which were in alliance with them and Illuminati, the Russians would have undoubtedly overrun the whole rotten, corrupt, crumbling edifice of the Turkish Empire, and they would have established Orthodox Christianity throughout the Middle East. But Britain dreaded the establishment of a Russian superpower stretching from the Arctic to the Indian Ocean. So to prevent Russia gaining ice-free ports for their navy, Britain became the protector and a guarantor of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, arguably one of the worst governments to have ever ruled in Europe. Turkey had been the greatest threat to the freedom of Europe throughout the centuries, and the Turks had twice besieged Vienna in the heart of Europe. They had sacked Budapest, taking hundreds of thousands of Christians into Islamic slavery from the very heart of Europe. In 1860, over 12,000 Christians were slaughtered in Lebanon. In 1876, 14,700 Bulgarians were murdered by the Turks. At the town of Batayo, over 7,000 inhabitants, 5,000 Christians were put to the sword. However, reports of these and other routine atrocities by the Ottoman Turks were generally suppressed by the British government of Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli for political reasons. And Disraeli was the first Jew to be Prime Minister of Britain. And although he pretended to be a Christian, it's more likely as a Sabbatean. And Disraeli saw it as more important to block Christian Russia's naval ambitions to secure an ice-free port by promoting an alliance of convenience, as he called it, with Muslim Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, which had been the greatest threat to Europe through the centuries. So 160-odd years ago, Western European powers interfered in the politics of Russia, invaded the Crimea, and as a result, strengthened the hand of radical Islam and saved Ottoman Turkish Empire from collapse. Instead of supporting civilization, instead of advancing freedom, the Western powers' intervention in Crimea in the 1854 to 1856 Crimean War had actually undermined freedom, retarded civilization, and maybe unintentionally, perhaps intentionally, led to even worse massacres of Christians in the extended life granted to the tyrannical Turkish Empire. And one wonders if history is not repeating itself with the intervention of Europe and NATO, Britain and America in propping up this American puppet government in Ukraine, arguably one of the most corrupt governments in the whole of Europe, possibly in the world right now. And what are they doing to Christianity in Eastern Europe right now? Gladstone opposed the Turkophile policies of Disraeli, as he called it. He said, "Disraeli is not so much a Turk as I thought. What he hates is Christian liberty and reconstruction." So Gladstone observed 140 years ago, could easily be applied to foreign policies of many Western governments today. It's not so much that they love Islam as much as hate Christianity. As Serge Trifkovic in The Sword of the Prophet observes, the great Western powers, the heirs of those who had looted Constantinople in the Crusades, who had refused to help when the Turks were breaking through the walls of Constantinople with a cannon built by the Hungarian Catholic, who forced the last emperors of Constantinople, of the Byzantine Empire, to reject the Orthodox faith at the Council of Florence as the price of the Western help that never came. Those same Western powers, and Great Britain in particular, actually supported the Turkish subjugation of Christian Europeans on the grounds that the Mohammedan Empire was a stabilizing force and a counterweight against Catholic Austria and Orthodox Russia. The scandalous alliance with Turkey against Russia in the Crimean War reflected a pernicious frame of mind that has manifested itself more recently in the overt, covert, or de facto support of Western powers for the Muslim side in Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Chechnya, Cyprus, Sudan, East Timor, and Kashmir. And it's true, why is it that the West consistently are helping Islamic sides against Christian? And they've done this in the wars in Bosnia. They've done it consistently in so many United Nations projects. And NATO has a horrible track record of bombing, for example, the Christian Serbs and supporting the Muslim Bosnians in the war in the Balkans. The Turks slaughtered over 200,000 Armenian Christians in Bayezid in 1877 and in Alashgurd in 1879 and Sassan in 1894 and in Constantinople in 1896, in Adan and in Armenia from 1895 to 1896. And in 1915, the Turks massacred more than 1.5 million Armenian Christians in the most intensive extermination of Christians ever launched to that point. Passage to Ararat is a book that describes how the road to Adana, Turkish women were given daggers to stab dying Armenians in order to gain the credit in the eyes of Allah of having killed a Christian. In 1881, the Turks slaughtered all the Christians in Alexandria, which is one of the greatest cities in the world at that time in Egypt. And in 1915 to 1916, another 100,000 Maronite Christians were slaughtered in Lebanon and Syria. So it's no wonder that the British Prime Minister Gladstone described the Muslim Turks as they were, upon the whole, from the black day that they first entered Europe, the one great anti-human specimen of humanity. Wherever they went, a broad line of blood marked the track behind them. As far as their dominion reached, civilization disappeared from view. They represented everywhere government by force as opposed to government by law. And even as the Ottoman Empire was crumbling and being replaced by the new Turks Republic of Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was almost certainly a Sabbatean, the ancient city of Smyrna, with its 300,000 Christian population, the last Christian city in Asia, was destroyed. The burning of Smyrna, the massacre of its Christian population, marked the end of Greek and Christian civilization in Asia Minor, the last of the seven churches in Asia being destroyed. On the eve of its destruction, Smyrna was a bustling port, a vibrant commercial center. Its seafront promenade was a popular tourist destination. But on 9th of September, 1922, the Turkish mob, organized and mobilized by the Turkish army under the command of Mustafa Kemal, or Atatürk, who was certainly, he was from Thessalonica, and almost certainly a Sabbatean, attacked the Greek Orthodox metropolitan Chrysostomos. The mob ripped out the eyes of this great Christian leader, dragged him by the beard, bleeding through the streets, beating him and kicking him. And every now and then, when he had strength to do it, he would raise his right hand and bless his persecutors, repeating, "Father, forgive them." And one Turk became so infuriated at this that he cut off the metropolitan's hand with his sword. And Father Chrysostomos was hacked to pieces by the angry mob. The burning of Smyrna, 13th of September, has been documented. There's even a film on Smyrna, 1922. The inhabitants were trapped between the flames on one side and the Turkish bayonets on the other. 13th of September, 1922, the Turks burned Smyrna, the last Christian city in Asia, burned it to the ground. But the biggest scandal is how the West treated this. Incredibly, there were British, American, Italian, and French warships anchored in Smyrna's harbor while this was taking place. But they were ordered by the government to maintain neutrality. So some of the eyewitnesses described the scene. The pitiful throng huddled together, screaming for help, mostly waiting in silent panic. Beyond hope, didn't budge for days. Typhoid had reduced the numbers. But there was no way to dispose of the dead. Occasionally, a person would swim out from the dock to one of the anchored ships and try to climb the ropes and chains, only to be driven off. On American battleships, the musicians on board were ordered to play as loudly as they could to drown out the screams of the pleading swimmers. The English poured boiling water down on these unfortunate refugees who had reached their vessel. The harbor was so clogged with corpses, the officers of the foreign battleships were often late to their dinner appointments because bodies got entangled in the propellers of their launches. A cluster of women's heads bound together like coconuts by their long hair floated down the river towards the harbor. That's eyewitness testimonies from Allied sailors who were in the harbor at the time. This was the end of Christianity in Turkey, or in Asia Minor. As Trifekvik observes, at the very time that Europe reached its military and geopolitical advantage, the moral and religious decline that culminated in the auto-genocides of 1914 and 1939 had become evident. Having found in their grasp places the Crusaders had only dreamed of reclaiming, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, the effete and demoralized European governments made no effort to re-Christianize these areas, and within a few decades had neatly abandoned them. the moral disarmament of contemporary post-Christian Europe is now nearly universal. After the First World War, with the installation of nominally pro-Western governments in many Muslim countries, fashioned from the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire, the West seems to have convinced itself of the existence of benign Islam, even as they have become more hostile towards Christianity. Entire Christian communities were obliterated in its heartland, in its birthplace in the Middle East. The Nestorians, the Chaldeans, and other Christian communities were virtually wiped out by the Young Turks and the Sabbateans behind them. As late as 6 September 1955, Istanbul's Christians suffered what one reporter called the worst race riot in Europe's history. In 7 hours, they destroyed and looted over 4,000 Christian homes, 1,000 Christian businesses, 73 churches, 3 monasteries, 23 schools, 110 Christian hotels, 27 pharmacies, causing over £100 million of damage to properties belonging to Christians. That was the riots of 6 September 1955 in Istanbul. Now, it's no wonder that William Muir, one of the greatest Orientalists of all times, he concluded at the end of his long and distinguished career, quote, "The sword of Muhammad and the Quran are the most fatal enemies of civilization, liberty, and truth which the world has ever known, an unmitigated cultural disaster parading as God's will." Well, the persecution of Christians by Muslims and by the genocide of Turkey have become forbidden subjects in Western circles. 14 centuries of religious discrimination and persecution, causing the suffering, oppression, and enslavement and murder of more than 270 million people, have been buried under thick whitewash of myths of Islamic tolerance. The deceit and the cowardice and the silence of all too many Western journalists and academics continue to facilitate the religious discrimination and persecution by radical Islam to this day. We need to say that the intellectual dishonesty of those Westerners who engage in academic gymnastics to justify the invasion of Christian lands, the looting, pillaging, raping, murdering, and enslaving of whole peoples needs to be exposed. And the hypocrisy of those who justify the military expansion of Muslims but condemn those who inflicted defeat upon these Islamic invaders needs to be challenged. The fiction that Islamic Jihad has never been aggressive but only a defensive concept should be dismissed with the contempt that such deception deserves. When Islam defines a refusal to submit to Sharia law under Islam as aggression, and when they define peace as submission to Islam, you must know we're not talking the same language. As one person described it, jihad seeks to conquer our souls. They seek the disappearance of our freedoms and our civilization. They seek to annihilate our way of living and our way of dying. They seek to annihilate our way of praying or not praying, our way of eating and drinking and dressing, our way of entertaining and informing ourselves. We don't understand, or we don't want to understand, that if we don't oppose them, if we don't defend ourselves, if we don't fight for Christian civilization, jihad will win, and it will destroy the world that, for better or worse, we have managed to build. It will destroy our culture, our art, our science, our morals, our values, and our pleasures. Our Lord Jesus said in John 8:32, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." It's absolutely vital that we learn the lessons of history, that we learn to stand up for religious freedom, to speak out for freedom of conscience, to expose the enemies of liberty and fight the good fight of faith. All the darkness cannot put out the smallest light. We must understand Islam and Sabbateanism, and we need to evangelize Muslims. We need to remember the persecuted. Remember the prisoners as if chained with them. Remember those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn declared, "If we do not know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again." And 1 Corinthians 10 tells us, "Now all these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted." Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they're written down for our admonition. And so there's much we can learn from history. And when people bring up the terms of genocide, remind them, do they know where the term came from? Do they know where the term originated? Do they know what the first genocide was that was documented in the 20th century? Do they understand what was behind it? And why is it that Western governments have consistently supported the biggest genocidal lunatics of the 20th century? From the Soviet Union to Ottoman Empire, consistently we see what was going on in the Rwandan genocide as well just 30 years ago, and how the West enabled it and how many of the architects of the genocides, including of the Rwandan genocide, are living in France and Canada being protected because they're French-speaking. And that somehow suits the purposes of the French government and so on, that yes, there might be genocidal mass murdering lunatics, but they're French-speaking, which means that they need to be protected. And this kind of nonsense of what's going on, whether it's the Tutsi Christians being murdered in Rwanda or the Armenian, Assyrian, and Greek Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire, why is it that Western governments, France and Britain in particular, consistently are on the wrong side? You know, if you make a mistake once, well, we're all human. If you make the same mistake twice, you're stupid. If you make the same mistake 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 times, you've got a hidden agenda. And it's impossible that Western governments can be so stupid that they've consistently been on the wrong side. And, you know, as my father, who fought all 6 years in the Second World War in the Eighth Army, North Africa and Italy, declared, he said, if we could have seen what would become of Britain after the war, we wouldn't have fought against the enemy we were put against in the First and Second World War. We would have fought together, shoulder to shoulder, against the real enemy. And I think that was the attitude of General George Patton as well. He wanted to fight against the real SOBs, who are the real enemies of our country, and he identified those as being in Washington, D.C. So, back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. That's fascinating, as always. So, the Armenian Genocide, it's got its own Wikipedia page as well. There was a lot of... I think there was some sort of something going on in recent years where people were struggling to get the Armenian Genocide actually recorded as a genocide because certain other group wanted that term reserved for themselves. But I believe in the end, whoever it was relented, and it's now commonly known as the Armenian Genocide. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, it is intriguing because... they were the Armenians are the ones who first coined the term genocide, and while it's been hijacked from them, interesting that others who came later are now sort of claiming that they've got the copyright, so to speak, and they've got a monopoly on the term, and you're not allowed to use it. When I published my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, I got into trouble and had people accusing me of being an anti-Semitic racist for using the term Holocaust in Rwanda to refer to the Tutsi Christians in Rwanda who were being massacred wholesale, hundreds of thousands. I mean, I walked knee-deep in corpses and churches in Rwanda, and I've got pictures of piles of skulls heaped up on top of pulpits and decomposing bodies in the churches and piles of skulls outside of churches. And there were pits, burning pits, where they were throwing live Protestant Tutsi Christians into, literally burning them alive. And you think you can't use the word Holocaust and genocide for that, whereas genocide... the official term is that it is to deal with the attempt to destroy a particular nation or ethnic group in whole or in part. I mean, that's the dictionary definition. And there are people attacking me for daring to use the word Holocaust and genocide, referring to what had happened to hundreds of thousands of Christians in Rwanda. According to the Genocide Museum in Kigali, Rwanda, 1.1 million Christians were killed in the genocide run by the Hutu government of Rwanda back in 1994. And you think what happened to the Armenians, what's happened to the Boers in 1900 to 1902 with the British concentration camp scorched earth. I've been to the Bloemfontein Women's Museum where they've got the names on the walls, names and places, names, dates and places for 34,000 Afrikaans women and children who were killed in the Anglo-Boer War. Names and places and dates. Now, at the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein, they've got one wall which has got the names and details of the 5,800 Boer or Afrikaans soldiers, farmers who died in the Anglo-Boer War. On the front of the wall, it's got the names of those who were killed in action. On the other side, those who died of wounds and diseases. And it comes to 5,800. That's the men. But facing it, 32,000 women and children who were killed in the same war. Now, where do you get a war where you've got six times more women and children killed than men? And that was the Anglo-Boer War, which Stephen Mitford Goodson published the book Genocide of the Boers, showing how the Rothschilds had deliberately engineered to wipe out the Boers in whole or in part to ensure the control of the Rothschild family of the gold and diamonds in South Africa. And you look at that and think, how can you not call that a genocide? Or what's going on today in South Africa, where you've got black leaders, Marxist leaders, dancing around screaming, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, you know, kill, kill, shoot to kill, bah, 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 bah. And there's members of parliament like Julius Malema standing on a stage in a huge football stadium leading tens of thousands of supporters in a zombie dance of singing about killing the Boers, killing the farmers. And they're doing it. Thousands of white South African farmers and their family members, wives and children, have been killed, crucified, tortured, dealt with in the most horrific ways. Murder doesn't even come close to describing what's done to them. And what's happened to the Tutsi Christians in Rwanda? What's happening to the Christian Nubians in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan or in Armenia? Or what's happened to the people in Cambodia under the communists there, or the Cambodian genocide and the abortion holocaust that's happening throughout much of the West? And then you think there's a group of people who think, no, we've got a monopoly on this term. We've somehow got the franchise for this term and nobody else is allowed to use it. And it's bizarre, especially when the Armenians are the first ones who used the term genocide. And now you've got people questioning the right to even use the term for what was plainly a genocidal attempt to wipe out Christianity from Turkish Empire and to establish an ethno-nationalist state in Turkey, where the Christians had preceded the Muslims there by more than 1,500 years. Armenians, remember, are the oldest Christian nation in the world, dating all the way back to the 2nd century. And Armenia was a great country. They sit astride the Caucasian Mountains, which includes the mountains of Ararat, where Noah's Ark landed. So they've got a great Christian heritage that go back very far. And I think it's quite bigoted and intolerant of people to deny people such as the Armenian survivors even the right to describe what happened to them historically. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And we've got about 15 minutes left. So I know we communicated by email about you had a couple of topics. Would you like to touch on the other topic at all in the 15 minutes, Cat in Forest, or do you not feel that we've got enough time to justify that?
Well, it does deserve more time, but it's worthwhile for us to note another horrific event that happened, in this case, 84 years ago, the Katyn Forest Massacre. I did a lot of ministry behind the Iron Curtain. My father-in-law, Bill Bathman, served 67 years as a missionary, mostly to Eastern Europe and serving persecuted churches throughout Eastern Europe, everywhere from Russia, Poland, down to Albania and Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, all these countries. And I had the privilege of traveling to 27 countries with my father-in-law, Bill Bathman, who is a contemporary and friend of Richard Vaughan, Brother Andrew, George Verve, and other missionary greats. And in my travels, I remember on a mission to Poland, 1990, I saw a monument for the victims of the Katyn Forest Massacre, and it said 1940. So I said, don't you mean 1941? And immediately the Polish people turned to me saying, don't tell me you believe the Soviet propaganda. And I was confused. And they were agitated of my ignorance because they explained that, well, in fact, they said to me, you betrayed us. I said, what do you mean we betrayed you? And said, well, you British Americans, you betrayed us. We never got any freedom or justice out of the Second World War. You betrayed us into the hands of Stalin's NKVD. And they had a very different view of Second World War history to what we have. And they pointed out that although Great Britain and France declared war on Germany on the 3rd of September 1939, ostensibly because Germany had invaded Poland, but Russia had also invaded Poland in 1939. And of course, as I said, most history books omit that fact. Well, the Katyn Forest Massacre was attributed for years, including in the history books, to Germany, that the Germans had killed the Polish officer corps. And the Allies even had the audacity to participate in judicial fraud at the Nuremberg trials, indicting the German Wehrmacht, the army, with what were plainly communist atrocities committed in Soviet Russia. So when I came out with what I'd been taught at school in textbooks, the Germans were guilty for the Katyn Forest Massacre, the Poles said to me, even under Soviet control, even before the Berlin Wall came down, they were angry at anyone who could come out with this propaganda. They said, find Katin on the map. And they put a map in front of me, and I'm looking and said, look further east, much further east. Look near Smolensk. There's Katin. Ah, gee, it's closer to Moscow than it is to Warsaw. And you're telling me the Germans massacred them in 1940? Don't be ridiculous. This was in Soviet Russia. It's a Russian atrocity. Do they ever show you a map in your history books when they tell you that Germany murdered the Polish officer corps in Katyn? Like, no, they've never shown a map, funny enough. First time I'd ever noticed where Katyn was. Well, they can't show you a map because that would immediately expose the lie. Well, this atrocity was covered up for so long, and the Polish people are quite outraged because their government in exile, General Sikorsky was the head of the Polish government in exile. He was assassinated on the 4th of July 1943 in Gibraltar, and there are films and books out on the assassination of General Sikorsky. And the Poles were quite horrified and disgusted over the fact that Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Britain, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt of the United States conspired to murder their Prime Minister, General Sikorsky, their war leader, because he was demanding an international Red Cross investigation into the Katyn Forest Massacre. And the evidence was overwhelming that the Soviets did the Katyn Forest Massacre. But Britain and America wanted to take the blame of their ally, Stalin's Soviet Union, and put it onto Germany. You know, how convenient, blame your enemy for what your allies are doing. And so there was all kinds of classified UK documents that have come out since confirming that the Soviet guilt was a certainty. But they deemed that their alliance with the Soviets was more important than the moral issue. And so they parroted the Soviet propaganda, and the censors suppressed all contradictory accounts. So, for example, US Navy Lieutenant Commander George Eagle produced a report confirming that the massacres were committed by the Soviet Union. There were all kinds of prisoners of war, for example, American prisoners of war, Lieutenant Colonel Donald Stewart and Colonel John Van Fleet, were taken by the Germans to Katyn as part of an international investigation into it, and they reported afterwards that there's no doubt the Soviets were definitely responsible for the massacre. And George Marshall, who is assistant of, who is the chief of staff, he destroyed the reports. He ordered these reports of the American prisoners of war destroyed. And during the congressional investigation of 1951 to 1952, General Bissett of intelligence defended his actions before Congress, saying it was not in American interest to antagonize the Soviet Union, which was America's ally. And so the Americans and the British, embarrassed by the Soviet inclusion of the Katyn Forest Massacre in indictments against the German military at Nuremberg trials, they rather suppressed the facts than admitted to what the facts were. So much for honesty from governments. And they sealed this for decades and decades. And so the Soviet general, Roman Rudenko, at the Nuremberg trial stated, one of the most important criminal acts for which major war criminals are responsible was the mass execution of Polish prisoners of war shot in the Katyn Forest near Smolensk by the German fascist invaders. And they described it as the worst massacre of prisoners of war in history. This is sheer, barefaced hypocrisy. This is a classic at hypocrisy. Judicial fraud and farce. At Nuremberg, the Soviets blamed Germany for what they knew. Everyone in the courtroom knew was a Soviet atrocity. Well, this took decades to come out, and they tried all kinds of lies in between. But Vladimir Putin and Yeltsin have handed over the files that have confirmed, without a shadow of a doubt, that Joseph Stalin ordered the massacre of these Polish prisoners of war. And these were the intelligentsia. These were the top leaders of Poland. And to think that the Allies went so far as to murder their ally, the Polish leader, during a war, during wartime. I mean, can you imagine? But here's the facts. In the first batch alone of Polish officers, there's over 22,000 Polish officers, NCOs, police officials, gendarmes, other intellectuals who were murdered in 1940, basically March 1940 into April 1940. And in the first batch alone, an admiral, two generals, 24 colonels, 79 lieutenant colonels, 258 majors, 654 captains, seven naval captains, 3,420 NCOs, seven chaplains, 20 university professors, 300 physicians, hundreds of lawyers, engineers, teachers, more than 100 writers and journalists, more than 200 pilots. They were all murdered by the Soviet NKVD in a 28-year period in April 1940. One NKVD executioner, Vasily Blonkin, he personally shot 7,000 of the condemned people, making him the biggest mass murderer in history in terms of personal killings, as opposed to ordering it like Joseph Stalin. Then you get into the millions. And they've got horrific details. They've got the report, 21,857 people were shot. The entire operation carried out on the basis of the decision of the Central Committee in April 1940. And the Soviets decided to destroy the records, but some records were kept, which includes the order to destroy these records. So funny that they even kept the records of, we're going to destroy all the records. But then there's more details of another 320,000 to maybe a million Polish citizens who were deported to the gulags, of which very few survived. Just one group of 12,000 Poles sent to Kolyma concentration camp, only 583 ever survived. And you can go through so much more of what the Soviets did. Well, it took 72 years for the story to come out, but by 2011, the European Court of Human Rights declared that Russia had violated the rights of victims' relatives, described the massacre as a war crime, 72 years later. And there's a lot of sources one can get on this. There's a film made by the Polish. If you go into East European Films, they've got Katyn, K-A-T-Y-N, and it is a Polish film with English subtitles on the Katyn Forest Massacre. I've also done a number of videos on the Katyn Forest Massacre as well, unraveling one of the many secrets of the Second World War. It's just another example of the kind of duplicity and lies. You wonder how long it'll take us to unravel the truth, because these things are embedded in our history books. It's embedded in the culture, the lies and propaganda of the Second World War. I praise God that my first history teacher in school in Rhodesia was a member of parliament, Mr. Rhys Davies, who said to us, beware the victor's version. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. And Mr. Rhys Davies, who is a member of parliament in Rhodesia, as well as being a history teacher, he said to us, you know that Britain is lying about us in Rhodesia now. Why would you trust what the British textbooks say about the Second World War, the First World War, or anything else for that matter? And he is dead right. It's taken me a lifetime to understand the full implication of what he said, but beware the victor's version. Governments lie. You cannot trust government textbooks. And Max Hastings, who produced the book The Secret War, he documented how, because of the Bletchley Park Enigma Code decipherings that were completely sealed for over 70 years, so when they came out, he said it requires every history book and film and documentary on the Second World War to be rewritten, because it just shows so much of what we've believed are lies. And the Secret War, now that you've got things that had been sealed for decades coming out, we can now begin to see how we've been lied about the most basic things, things that people have taken for granted in the culture. Films have been made and things, leaving out the most pertinent points, which just show the treachery and duplicity on the West side. And I think the most powerful book on this is Freedom Betrayed by President Herbert Hoover, which we've done a program on, where Herbert Hoover documented how FDR was conniving for the war, manipulating for the war, and had actually put Poland up to not handing over the German city of Danzig and reversing the injustice of Versailles, and promised all kinds of support, which never came. And then cajoled and bribed the British and French to give war guarantees to Poland, and then never backed them up either. And the end result was Europe basically destroyed itself as the superpowers of the 20th century, and were replaced by the Soviet Union and by the United States of America. And that this was FDR's doing it. And so this is from President Herbert Hoover's book, Freedom Betrayed, showing how America didn't get dragged into the Second World War. America initiated the Second World War through their State Department and all kinds of duplicitous dealings, bribery, blackmail, bullying, promises, and treachery. And their goal was the destruction of the British Empire and basically subjugating Europe to being the plaything of the superpowers of Britain, of United States and Soviet Union. And these things need to be known. People need to know their history. If we don't know our history, we can easily be deceived. So back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And I found an article here from The Guardian, a famous British newspaper, left-leaning. It was originally published on Friday, 26th of November 2010, so it's more than 13 years old. Headline, Russian Parliament Admits Guilt Over Polish Massacre. And basically, they finally at that time declared that Joseph Stalin ordered his secret police to execute 22,000 Polish army officers and civilians in 1940. Today's acknowledgement of Stalin's personal culpability over the Katyn massacre comes amid a cautious thaw between Moscow and Warsaw. I'm reading you little selections here. Mikhail Gorbachev admitted in 1990 that the NKVD was to blame for the massacre after a half century of the Soviets blaming it on Nazi troops. However, there has never been a formal statement which implicates the Soviet leadership in such explicit terms as that statement by the Russian parliament over 13 years ago. So I think it's worth just throwing that one in from a mainstream source. But Peter, any comments before we move on?
Yes, well, you know, what lies behind us and what lies before us are small things to those things that lie straight before our face. I think they call television programming for a reason. We've been lied to. We might be the most propagandized, lied to and deceived population in the history of the world. I'm thinking particularly of the United States and Great Britain's population. The evidence is that we've been lied to by our governments on so many different things. It's extremely hard to take seriously anything they say. And right now they're lying to us about a bunch of things too. I mean, we don't have to go that far back to, you know, weapons of mass destruction and Iraq and all of that sort of thing. Wars have been fought on the base of lies. And entire populations mobilized. Now, we honor the soldiers who fought. And, you know, I respect my dad and others who fought in the Second World War. But one needs to spare a thought for the fact that the politicians who sent them often sent them on the basis of lies, lies, and more lies. And often for the interests of the bankers and the industrialists and the people who have a Sabbatean agenda, Illuminati agenda, rather than something that's in the real national interest. And you can only think of that here in South Africa. Our country was destroyed in the Anglo-Boer War for what? For the Rothschilds' desire to control the gold in the Transvaal. There was no other real reason. And they destroyed 30,000 farms, poisoned wells, killed millions of domestic animals, cattle and sheep and horses, millions, and incarcerated all the women and children in Transvaal and Free State into concentration camps where they died at such a rate. Emily Harpas documented the Boers were dying at the rate of 250 per thousand per year. That means in 4 years, there'd be no one left alive. That's a worse track record than the concentration camps of the Second World War. And that was run by the British in 1990 to 1902 in South Africa. The year, the century began with genocide and scorched earth and concentration camps. And sadly, the British Empire was at the forefront of it, and they were doing it for the Rothschilds for the same reason that the Opium War was fought with China in the 1840s. The Rothschilds wanted trade with China. China was not interested. They had nothing that they wanted from the West. And so the Rothschilds started to grow opium in India and smuggle opium into China and created a bunch of drug addicts. Kind of the reverse of what's happening today, where the Chinese military intelligence are running drug dealing and drug pushing in Europe and America right now to debase the people in the West. Well, the Rothschilds did that in China back in the 1840s. And then when China fought against it, the Royal Navy was mobilized by the Rothschilds to support their drug smuggling operation and compel China to accept Rothschild drug dealers coming into China. I mean, that's the Opium War. And to think that the Royal Navy and the British Army were mobilized as mercenaries for the Rothschilds in the 1840s in China and in 1900s in the Anglo-Boer War, yeah, it's scandalous. And you wonder how much of what we're doing today, whether it's Americans in Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever other operations we're involved in, how many of these have similar nefarious kind of origins and purposes? We are being lied to such a degree that I think the Donald Trump idea of no more useless foreign wars makes a lot of sense. Let's pull our people back. I'm not a pacifist. I believe there's a time to fight, but I don't believe in fighting for some Sabbatean, Illuminati, or New World Order Rothschild purpose. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And before we go, can you please let the audience know where they can find your work and how they can contact you?
Yes, certainly. So our mission website is frontlinemissionsa.org, Frontline Mission, FrontlineMissionSA, SA short for South Africa. So frontlinemissionsa.org is the website, and you'll find audiovisual links there. My personal email is peter@frontline.org.za, or as the Americans say, ZA, peter@frontline.org.za.
Thank you, Peter. And that brings us to the end of our show today. So as I say, I want to thank Peter so much for joining us for a show entitled The Real Story of the Origin of the Term Genocide. I want to thank all of you for listening. Peter and I will be back with you at the same time next week. I'll be back with you all on Saturday. And until then, folks, have a wonderful day and bye for now.